Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's March 6, 2012. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43. We're sponsored by GreatBrewers.com. Learn more about beer and the beer community on GreatBrewers.com and supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, GoodBeerSeal.com. Well, here we are with Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn Brewery, Chris Kuzme from New York City Homebrewers Guild, and Mary Izett from Ale Street News.
Rastafari and mighty God.
All right, brother. Yeah.
Oh, wait, you told me this was religious studies.
Well, it kind of is.
It kind of is.
We believe in four deities: water, yeast, malt.
The sub theme tonight could be homebrewers turn pro.
It's true.
But I think the real theme is it's Japan and Japanese beer.
Do you have news?
You heard it here first, folks.
All right. But we had Mr. Toshi Kayuchi in town from Hitachino Brewery, and he was last night at Jimmy's Number 43. And today he spent the day with Garrett at Brooklyn Brewery.
We had some fun, as we always do. I'm looking forward to getting back to Japan. In fact, I don't know when Chris is going to Japan, but I know that he is. And I'm pre-jealous for whenever he does go. I don't even know what it is. I'm already pre-jealous. That's just kind of the way I am about Japan.
You going to Japan, Chris?
Not that I know of, not yet. Yes, I am.
You have been to Japan, have you?
I have, but only to the airport, unfortunately. I'm mostly, my Asia has all been China.
You've been
less beer in China.
You've been all over the world. I just assumed Japan, especially as a jazz guy.
Yeah, it's definitely on my list for sure.
Mary, have you been to Japan?
Nope. But it's also on my list.
Well, tell us about Japan, Garrett. You guys, does Brooklyn Brewery sell beer in Japan?
We do. In fact, Japan was our first export market ever. 2 years after we started, 1990, we started selling beer in Japan. So we're the top exporting brewery in the United States now, which is kind of weird. And Japan is not among our very top markets, but it's cool. And it was great. I mean, I think everybody has heard probably by now the story of our beer, Sirachi Ace. Well, when I went over there, I actually brought the Sirachi hop back to Japan, because it was originally developed in 1978 by the Sapporo Brewery. And actually, when I talked to the guys at Kyuchi, and they're better known to beer fans as Hitachino, and I never knew, Hitachi is the area, and Hitachino is something from the area. So the Hitachi televisions and whatever else, same thing. It's just Hitachino. Nope. I'll bet you didn't realize that. That's a little fun fact. See, I'm full of useless information. But in any case, I brought the Sirachi hop back, and they had never heard of it. But they said to me, and I loved this. It stuck with me. They said, Sirachi sounds like a name from Hokkaido. And it's sort of like a funny thing about language. It's like somebody saying to you, Clem. That sounds like a name from the Southwest or something like that. Sirachi might sound Japanese to us, but to say it sounds like a name from Hokkaido, you kind of wonder, okay, what is it about it that sounds like a name from Hokkaido? But it's in fact true. It's an area of Hokkaido prefecture. And so and they now brew their Nipponia with it. So that's cool.
Oh, that's great. So where did you find the Sirachi hop?
I believe it was at the Craft Brewers Conference. It was the same year that it was released commercially, so that was 2008. We used it 2009, which is only really a few months later, to make Sirachi Ace as the Brewmaster's Reserve draft beer. We made bottles for ourselves on the side, as we usually do with most things, and we just got hooked on it. So, this past year, it became a permanent new beer for us. And it's only really being grown these days by one guy in Washington State, Darren Gamesh, Family Farm. And so they're the only people in the world. People are trying to catch up with them, but the only people in the world right now commercially growing Sriracha Ace, and there's only about 15 acres on Earth producing right now. So,
wow. Well, going back to what you said, so your Brooklyn Brewery is the largest exporter of beer.
It's kind of weird, you know, like where the we export about more than 10% of overall production goes overseas. The number two market for Brooklyn Brewery outside of New York City itself is, in fact, Sweden.
Wow.
You know, that is it's a weird little fact. We spend a lot of time over there. Half of the people who work for Brooklyn Brewery have been to Sweden. The other half have been to Italy. And we've done a bunch of stuff over there, too. So I actually leave Monday night. I will be in the UK, and then I'm going to Berlin for the first time in many years. So last time I was in Berlin, there we also went to East Berlin. So it's been a little while. So it's going to be pretty interesting. I hear Berlin's very cool these days.
I hear it's cool, too. I'd love to go with you. But for Japan, do you actually export the beer from New York to Japan, or do they have a partner that makes
it? Yeah, we actually have, and until we started brewing IPA in Italy, Toshiyuki and Kyuchi were the only people who were actually brewing for us outside the country under license. So the first time when I went over there, you know, we brewed Brooklyn Lager. We brewed a beer called Sriracha Gold from the 11 pounds of Sriracha Ace hops that I brought with me. We used in hopping and dry hopping for a little batch. And then we brewed Brooklyn Lager. And so he's been doing that for about 2.5 years now. There is a chain of bars, believe it or not, you know, called, you know, that have a Brooklyn theme to them. And the idea is, like, it's supposed to look kind of like a basement bar in Park Slope was the idea. I'm like, there's a lot of books in here for a basement bar in Park Slope, you know, but okay, it's a pretty cool looking place. And, you know, so that's, you know, that's very cool. But, I just love, the aesthetics of the culture. I mean, great food. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful sake. The beer writer and food writer, Brian Harrell, you know, who's been there for 30 years, took me around. And one night I just said to him, I want you to take me someplace that I would never, ever, ever, you know, find if I was a tourist. And that even if I did, I wouldn't dare walk in, you know, with food that I've never heard of before. And boy, we got some weird stuff.
Is there a name that you can remember?
Oh, man, we had a dish that's made from I didn't know that when you heat soy milk, apparently it gets a skin on it, kind of like regular milk does. And so they had a dish where they would get the soy milk to form this skin, then they would pull it off, and it was sort of this slimy and then that would be served together with some fish or whatever else. It was actually pretty good, but you know, there are some things there.
The special guest gets the slime.
Yeah, I eat a lot of sushi and a lot of, you know, things, a lot of ramen and stuff like that. But there's the stuff that doesn't really translate for Americans is the extreme slime factor. You know, and there are a lot of extremely slimy dishes there. But Tsukiji Fish Market is one of the coolest things I've ever seen in my life. I mean, I don't know how many acres. I think it's, I don't know, something like 15 acres under roofs. So it's like it's a massive building, and it looks like the entire ocean has been emptied out, and there are a bunch of people running around, you know, cutting up all the fish in the entire world. Unbelievable.
Wow. So what's the Japanese beer scene like?
Japanese beer scene is highly curated. There are some great bars. The Japanese brewers themselves, the beers they make are very high quality. They're not, perhaps, generally speaking, as creative, say, as the Italians, but their brewing skills are much better. So they're kind of they're more restrained in some ways, and they're focusing a little bit more on what they're doing. I mean, you don't get very many bad beers in Japan, unlike when you go to a lot of countries that are kind of just getting started in their craft brewing scene. You know, and Italy is making, you know, wonderful beers and horrible beers. You get a lot of great beers in Japan, but you don't get many horrible beers because nobody wants to step quite that far out there. I think it's a little bit of a cultural thing. Whereas in Italy, it's kind of la bella figura. Yeah. You know, a little bit of style is you know, might count more than substance sometimes. So I'm stereotyping, but they're my friends.
Well, let's go back to Mr. Kiyuchi. So this is a special relationship I didn't know about. I didn't know that Kiyuchi Brewery was making Brooklyn Lager.
Yeah, they're making Brooklyn Lager. And, you know, I mean, we, of course, used to sell their beer, you know, because we used to be a distributor. So, you know, we sold the Hitachi no beers. And so it's been great to see this flourishing of what's going on there. And there's a fascinating beer scene. There are a lot of there are some Americans, people who are sort of kind of were Americans are working over there. There's the history of brewing in Japan is actually fascinating, because when I was working on the Oxford Companion to Beer, I was reading a lot of stuff when I was doing the editing. And by, I think it was by the late 1880s or so, the main Japanese breweries that we know, Kirin, Asahi, Sapporo, they were all set up. And they were set up by Germans, they were set up by Americans. And the first beer breweries there, sort of European-style beer breweries, actually catered largely to other Europeans and Americans who were working in Japan after the opening of Japan. So it took a long time for beer to become the main thing in Japan, but there's one thing people don't know. In Japan, the main drink by far, by a long, long shot, is beer. You know, it is not sake. You know, sake, people drink it, people like it. I love sake, but sake is not the drink of Japan today. You know, probably I would imagine that something like 70% of all the sort of alcoholic beverage drunk in Japan is beer. And it's everybody talks about it all the time.
Wow, so that's a great beer country.
Yeah, it is a great beer country in many ways. Now, you know, they went through the same thing that we did, kind of industrialization, standardization. They kept a few things like this interesting sideline in kind of Schwarz beer type styles, because the Germans had been there. Sometimes the same thing you see in China, where, you know, Qingdao, for example, was set up as a monastery. It was a German set up monastery, and Qingdao started brewing because the Germans started brewing beer there. So you see that story a lot, and the same thing happened there. So you see offshoots of Schwarz beer, you see offshoots of Weiss beer as this stuff starts to come back. But Kiyuchi was among the first people to start brewing when Japan changed their laws and started to allow small brewers. But they're a 150-year-old sake brewery, actually. That is what that's their main business. So many people who might drink their beers don't realize that this is, you know, a serious and very old sake brewery.
So I know a lot of brewers from around the world, when they come to New York, they go to the Mecca, they visit you at Brooklyn Brewery. What do you do? Like, Toshi Kiyuchi was with you today. Just walk around? Do you, like, stir pots? What do you do? I mean, you know, international beer, you know.
Well, there's a lot more to do diplomacy now than there was a year and a half ago, because it used to be we just would take you into, like, you know, one or two rooms. I'm like, that's it. And they'd be like, really? And we're like, really? Now we kind of wrap around the block. So we start off tasting some stuff. Then we kind of go through the whole brewing facility, then across the street to the re-fermentation rooms, then to the barrel room. Then we go into the cold room. Usually I grab a couple of special bottles. We come across the street and start tasting some things. So, and we got into talking about, you know, ideas for, you know, various collaborations and things that we might do. I mean, they have a lot of very cool ideas, and I have no doubt of their ability to pull them off. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of great opportunities there. So far, Americans don't really necessarily know the Japanese beer scene that well. You know, we know Hitachi no, we know one or two others maybe, but, you know, it's not many of those beers come here. So I think that might be the next cool wave, the same way that we got the wave of Italian beers 4 or 5 years ago. We may well see a wave of Japanese beers come in, you know, by one importer at one point, and then suddenly we're going to have all this cool stuff.
I love the Hitachi no beers. Right now we have in front of us the real ginger ale, which to me is kind of unusual.
It suggests to me that somewhere there is lurking the fake ginger. and that worries me.
When you approach it as a brewer, like, they've got red rice ale, the ginger ale. You know, how do they work with those different ingredients, or what's unusual about these beers that Hitachino makes?
Well, I mean, in the case of the real ginger, that's almost like more of a... It strikes me as a throwback to some British stuff, like the original ginger ales, you know, which we don't think of the fact that ginger ale was, in fact, an ale, you know, back in the days. Not a soft drink from Canada Dry.
This beer, the Hitachi, I caught that one.
Yeah.
The Hitachi, the real ginger. It actually tastes like ginger ale.
Yeah, no, yeah. It does. But, you know, we forget that was an alcoholic beverage at one time. So we've got that going on. But I'm actually, as much as I like that beer, I'm much more fascinated by the Red Rice Ale, which, of course, you know, they're doing a number of beers that are incorporating sort of sake-making techniques, sake yeast that produce these really interesting melony flavors and things like that. And in that way, they're really creative. You know, it's very easy for people to say, oh, well, they've been around for a while and everybody knows them or whatever. But they are, in fact, they remain among the creative, you know, of the brewers, even when you're over there checking out a lot of different, Japanese breweries. So, you know, I love the aroma of this beer. I love the color. And it depends on the light. You know, you kind of switch it this way and it looks kind of golden. Then you hit the light in a different direction and it's pretty red. Mm-hmm. It's kind of pinkish looking. The rice gives it a real twinge of, kind of a racy acidity.
How much rice is in this beer?
You know what? I knew that at one time and I've forgotten it, but it's a decent amount. And I know they do convert some of it into sugar using the koji, you know, the mold that is used for breaking down starch into sugar. So it's interesting that you had these two different technologies, if you like, of taking grain and converting it into sugar so you could ferment it. You could either malt it, you know, as we did with barley, and then develop those enzymes, etc. Or in this case, and I don't know, this seems like a much harder way to do it to me. Mm-hmm. But somebody at some point left some rice out, and it got moldy, and it got moldy and sweet, and maybe, you know, it rained on it or something, and then, like, the stuff starts fermenting. Who knows exactly how they discovered the sake-making technique, but have basically preserved something that almost certainly was a matter of happenstance, you know, many thousands of years ago, and kept going with it. So this is, even though these places are called breweries, and sake is essentially a beer. I mean, people call it rice wine. It's not wine at all. You're not squeezing a fruit and getting a juice. You're taking grain with starch and converting it into sugar and fermenting it. That's beer. Or you can just say that it's just sake, but it's certainly much closer to beer. We don't know very much about it. I mean, not many of us do. Have you ever made sake, Chris?
I have not.
I've made amazake.
Ah, yamazake is a type of sake, right? With kind of a lactic fermentation as well.
Yeah, well, I use the, how do you pronounce it, koji?
Koji.
Yeah, so I used that, and it just went for, I think I fermented for maybe 24 to 48 hours at a higher temp, so I had to use a cooler to keep it warm.
Right.
So it was low alcohol, and then I pureed it to make more of an amazake shake than a porridge.
That's that slime factor that we were talking about.
It was pretty tasty, though.
Tasty slime, yeah. I went to a restaurant this one time, and I got this stuff, and I'm like looking at the sushi and whatever else, and it said Green Mountain Yam. And I'm like, oh, that sounds delicious. I love yams. And I get this bowl of goo, and I put my spoon into it. As I pull the spoon away, filaments, you know, about a foot or more long are just stretching out of this bowl, you know, and I'm pulling it up a foot and a half. It's still connected, you know, between the spoon and the bowl, and I'm like, oh, no.
Different food culture, but they're making beers that we like. So
yeah.
The red rice, they make it with rice. Now, the ginger beer, what do they do? How do you make ginger beer that's beer?
You know what? I am not sure of what their technique is. When we made the concoction last year, we had several different ways that we looked at doing it. And we actually steeped the beer, it had finished the fermentation, and we steeped it with minced ginger. And the thing about ginger is that ginger flavor oxidizes very quickly. So if you make a ginger syrup or something, say you're a bartender, you want like a ginger syrup, you can only hold on to it for about a week at the most in the fridge. So the thing is that ginger juice, for example, often has a caramelized, oxidized character. I like ginger when it tastes fresh and has a little bit of a burn to it, which this does. So I kind of suspect that they're adding minced ginger, and I'm sure he told me at one point, but then we had a bunch of beers and things went out the window.
Well, awesome.
It does say on the back, fresh ginger roots added to the brew kettle. I don't know if they do more than that, but...
Okay, so in this case, then, they have a kettle addition, and they're getting that flavor out of the kettle addition, and then it's going through fermentation and... you know, and coming through. So it's nice that they haven't blown it all off. It's a beautiful beer.
Mm-hmm. Awesome, cool. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back on Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network in a few minutes. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Gary, you're so quiet tonight.
Oh, you have cats. Hep cats are swinging.
All right. That's right. Well, we should say that we're sponsored by GreatBrewers.com and supported by the Good Beer Seal, GoodBeerSeal.com. We've got Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn Brewery, Chris Kuzme from Wandering Star.
Hey, Wandering Star.
And Mary Isaac from everything. L Street News, MyLifeOnCraft.com.
Wait. You can just say from Wandering Star and not tell us what Wandering Star is. Chris, tell us what Wandering Star is.
So, Garrett, you're saying this is from home brewer to pro brewer, Chris Kuzme?
I don't know yet. He's going to tell
me. I wouldn't
me
say that I'm not. I go out and brew with Chris maybe once a month at best, but mainly I'm doing sales and marketing here in New York. Wandering Star is a new brewery. We opened on June 14th, got licensing in Massachusetts, from Western Massachusetts, 15 barrel system, and we have 9 beers out right now, a couple of them being seasonal, and we're just happy to be here.
So this is the same, this is the brewery that Alex Hall's also working with. Are you doing all cask beers, or do you have bottle stuff?
We are not bottling or canning yet. We're just doing cask and keg, and we're only sending cask to accounts that we know are going to treat it right, so you know we're being rather particular with
that. I love how canning is mentioned now. You are the first person I heard. We're not bottling or canning yet. This is not a phrase that anybody would have said even 5 years ago. Canning wouldn't have been mentioned. Right. Interesting.
Well, I think we want to can, you know, when we get to that point of packaging.
Are you trying to be a meme? Are you trying to make canning into a meme? I'm going to do a little the honors here.
Woo! So what's this beer, Garrett?
All right, we have a version. You guys have had versions before. I'm not sure you've had this one. This is a version of the Crochet Rouge series. This is a series of beers which originates with our local one, kind of Belgian strong golden, and is aged on sediment from natural wine fermentations from our great friends at the Red Hook Winery in Red Hook, Brooklyn. And so 9 months on natural wine lees. The lees are the sediment. Now, this in particular, you certainly had the Crochet Rouge Rosé, which was on lees from Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. This is the Riesling version. I haven't had this myself in 5 or 6 months.
I can taste the Riesling.
Yeah, you really can.
You did one of these with Botrytis Riesling, is that correct?
Yeah, and that was the first one of them that we ever did. And that was about 2.5 years ago. This was about a little more than a year ago. So this is a different one than you had before.
Okay. This is my fourth one, I think, and they're all delicious.
Well, I'm glad you like it. We thought that the rosé version was a little bit more realized, a little bit better married, etc. This one's a little bit bigger and more muscular because Riesling is a, it's a very Teutonic grape. I'm just saying, it's trying to take over a little bit.
So this is a big trend now: aging beer in bourbon barrels, whiskey barrels. You're doing in wine barrels.
Well, no, these are whiskey barrels, but they're second use. So we're trying to reduce the influence of the barrel by not using a fresh barrel in this situation. We would like to have some barrel character, but not to have it out front. So as you can taste, it's got some sourness to it. As it warms up, you're going to get a lot of Brettanomyces funk from, the natural yeast from the countryside. And what we're overall working on is trying to grow up and be able to reuse actually an indigenous set of yeasts.
You know, this brings up for me a lot of the beers that you've made and other brewers too who are on the cutting edge. I feel like a lot of these beers could use some time before they go to market. And I don't know if you guys have plans for that.
Well, this beer has forever before it goes to market because we can't make enough of it to market. But if you ever see one of that we've put out a thing that says that we're doing Ghost Bottle Night, that is your opportunity to taste these things. We call them ghost bottles. They're the beers that don't exist.
So you can go to the Brooklyn Brewery and taste these beers.
Yeah, look at brooklynbrewery.com. You'll see that there are events. You normally can't even taste these beers. We show up. This is what we bring to dinners and things like that. For example, this is really nice. I made this, and I made Oysters Rockefeller.
Wow.
And had this with it. It was kind of awesome. A little bit acidic and some nice wine flavors.
Well, I've been lucky to get, the reason I bring that up is that I've been lucky to get some of your special kegs that have been held back. Like last when you made the concoction last year,
held back. When I was a child, that meant something completely different. Yeah. Well, what are you trying to say?
I'm on the lucky team here, guys. I get specialty kegs all the time. From,
are you saying my beer is special? What are you trying to say?
Special. Listen, there's a woman on your staff. Hey guys, there's Carla Villa. She works at Brooklyn Brewery. When she has some special kegs, that she calls me up and I get them. And one of them was you made the concoction last summer.
Yes.
And they had held back a couple of the kegs. And I got them around Christmas time. And people, you could see the change, in 6 months of how more complex it got. And I can see that with the special bottling that you brought tonight.
Well,
a few years ago, I want to say the Schneider Weiss Hopfen. What was that beer that you did? The Schneider Hopfen Weiss thing?
Yeah, well, that is probably the best known of our collaborations. It's one thing people don't know about us. We were the first brewery by a fairly long shot in the United States to do collaborative brewing with other breweries. And so we started in the late 90s before it became, fashionable. I think it's cool that it's fashionable. The one that people know the best is the Hopfen Weiss, which, of course, Schneider still brews. And that was really an expression of the friendship between me and Hans-Peter Drexler, who's Schneider's brewer. And last several years, we've ended up on vacation together at the same time in Italy. His family hangs out with my family. My brother teaches his kids how to play guitar. So we're really tight. And so that beer, the first time I ever tasted Hopfen Weiss was actually on the Italian coast with my family and his family overlooking the Mediterranean.
Wow.
He had re-fermented the beer in the back of his car while on vacation in Corsica. That is a true story and one that you couldn't possibly make.
Well,
up.
That's the experience I want because it was a couple years ago. One of those beers that your collaboration with Schneider. There have been some kegs that have been stashed on the side, and I got a year old version.
It ages well,
yeah.
much better than you would think. It gains a real tropical fruit sort of character to it. And what's interesting is the serendipity of beers. I mean, as a brewer, I tend to be we have some rigidity to us. We have ideas. We have intentions. And when you taste a beer. And it's older than you ever really thought of it being. You made a draft beer, and then it was gone. And then somebody brings it back a year later, and you're like, oh, maybe it has a twinge of acidity. Oh, maybe it's gone this way. Maybe it's gone that way. And it's taken me a long time to kind of let go of my idea of what I thought it was supposed to be when it was fresh and let it be what it is when it's old. And if it tastes nice, be fine with it. And that takes a certain kind of mindset that, that winemakers are used to. And I think what's fascinating to me is, like, you know, Chris is just getting started in creating these beers. They're available, you know, in kegs. And you're going to be dealing with this real soon. Now, maybe you've dealt with it with your home-brewed beers that, like, have, you know, gone a different direction than you expected. Right. But now it's different when you're selling beer to people and when you walk into a bar. And it's like, it's almost like hearing somebody do a cover of your song, you know, or a weird cover, or even better than that, like there was some, I don't know, some board mix that you never thought was going to make it out in public, and you're right. Like, okay, it's not what I wanted them to hear. Exactly. It's cool, yeah, it's actually really live, and it sounds great, but I didn't intend it. So, I mean, have you been out there long enough to kind of see beers start to evolve as they inevitably do in directions that maybe you wouldn't even have expected?
Absolutely. I mean, we did a summer beer that was really light, and it was called the Alpha Pale Ale. It was a really light 4.4% alcohol beer, and it showed up around I think November, and we saw it in November, like one of the last kegs, and it just changed. I thought to the worst, but other people seemed to like it a lot, but you know, it wasn't what we wanted it to represent.
Well, the reason I'm bringing this, I'm trying to urge brewers to hold back some of their beers, because like a complex beer like your concoction, or you know, a lot of other breweries are doing like these 10% beers that have little extra sugar in them, and they're really intense, but I'm like, gosh, I feel like in 1 year those beers would be so much better. And you know, for us in the supply chain, it goes, you guys, everyone's moving beer. It goes brewery, distributor, bar. Nobody wants to hold on to it.
Well, what's hard is, you know, it's hard. There's two parts that are hard. There's like you know, for the distributor definitely doesn't want to hold on to beer because they've paid for it already. And if you wait for 2 years and you've paid for it, that's rather a lot of money you might have tied up in that stock. The brewer has to really think hard to hold on to beer, because almost everything that we're creating, everybody wants all of it. So what you basically have to do is hold on to beer that somebody wants to give money to you for right now. So you've got, say, it's Black Chocolate Stout. You have 150 cases sitting there. You have orders for it, and you're saying no. Like, I have it, and I'm not going to sell it. That is not the natural way of business. You know, we don't think that way. The beer has been released. So, of course, if the beer has been released, you should be able to buy it. Well, you know, and we've had a couple of incidents at the brewery where we sold more of a particular beer than I wanted to. And we don't have a policy of saying how much of each thing we hold on to. But we know we have to have like a deep sort of back bench, because when it comes time to kind of do special events and whatever else, if you sell everything, then you have nothing. And you are really dependent upon the retailer. Or the bar or the restaurant to hold on to beer for you. And many of them do. They do a great job. They have wonderful things. I remember in the old days of Blind Tiger, you know, back in the old Blind Tiger, we did an event called, it was called Three-Headed Monster, our Monster Ale barley wine. They had 3 years of it. I happened to have two other years, earlier years, and I never knew what am I going to do with these ancient kegs, you know, from the late 90s. So we turned it into the Five-Headed Monster. You know, we kind of made it into this flight on draft of 5 years of this barley wine. So it's very cool when, in many cases, we can do events that the bar has held on to some stuff, and then we have other stuff. But, you know, it's hard to hold on to beer. It really is. I mean, you know, I'm sure you're learning it now. Like, you know, how much vintage stuff do you have waiting around? It's like, you know, people are buying your stuff. You're like, okay, have some, yeah. You know. But I'm telling you, if you're not doing it, you know, Local 2, you know, our beer Local 2. I mean, we have the original test bottlings of Local 1. We really haven't held on to Local 2, and we've been brewing it now for 3 years. It's just, you know, you're in it every day, and you're brewing. You're getting the beer, you know, done. The beer's tasting nice. Now, you don't say to yourself, okay, let's set this aside, and then we will drink it in 2 years. Yeah, and so...
So it's tough. So it's hit or miss. You might get lucky. You might not sell something. You might hold something.
Well, that's
back.
The other thing. It might actually not be good in 2 years. So there's somebody who wants to give you money for it right now. It's like, no. Wait until it... Oh, it's spoiled. You know, like in 2 or 3 years, you just don't know. You're taking a risk. So it's interesting. We're trying to think hard about it. One thing that I would love to do is I want to make a massive barley wine in the old Thomas Hardy style that is so big that really you can't drink it for 2 or 3 years. I mean, really just forget about it. And that's really hard to do because you just know that you just have to set it aside and you're like, when I'm this age, you're like, ooh. Whatever, take whatever age you are and add 3 years. You know, just so not, you know, in that not, case, it's not good.
You're going to do something special, like just a bottling of it.
Yeah, we would just bottle it and maybe keg some of it and literally put it away for 3 years and try not to think about it. It's not the way we think, but increasingly, we're trying to think that way, and it's a thing that beer forgot. You know, beer forgot many things, and one of the things it forgot is the whole idea of vintage beers, and it used to be common, and now it's not. I mean, it's coming back.
Well, the reason I brought this up, it's been on the tip of my tongue for months, because, you know, every time I get, whether it's a year-old, you know, Brooklyn Schneider collaboration, or it's concoction 6 months later, or recently it was last summer, I got a bunch of the Ridgeway 2010 holiday beers. I didn't get into the summer, and I said, well, I'm going to hold them until November. And there's definitely something else that happens when you age. Really good beers. And we can talk more about this in other shows, but it's definitely put it out there that people should think, you know what? A lot of the beers, especially over 8%, wouldn't hurt from a little more time.
Yep.
And someone has to figure out whether – I have a feeling that there'll be some retailers that are bigger – that'll probably step up and say, we're going to start doing a...
Gramercy Tavern was very early in this whole thing. The first serious restaurant that I'm aware of in the United States who established a vintage beer program. For 5 or 6 years now, they have had a vintage beer list. Now, the first vintage beer list, that I saw before that, it could be that Higgins in Portland, Oregon may have had one earlier. Because they've been serious about it for a long time, but that's still kind of a killer list. You can go there and get like Gale's Prize Old Ale, like 1997, and stuff like that, and that's very cool stuff to be able to get in a restaurant.
No, that's great, and that's the future. But let's we're gonna just start tasting some cheeses here. Saxelby Cheesemonger sent us two different cheeses from Vermont, and we're gonna start eating these and coming up with some pairings. We'll be back on Beer Sessions Radio.
Chicago, that's the last place my baby stayed.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're out here at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It's a pretty cool place. What do you think of the food out here, Garrett?
Oh, food's excellent. You know, Roberta's is known far and wide, and they've got it's getting to springtime. They've got a big garden going on. They're going to start growing a lot of ingredients that are going to end up on pizzas and things like that. Maybe even in some beers. We've got some conversations to have here, so we'll kind of see what happens. We've got some cheese in front of us, and what I love about beer and cheese together is that you kind of have the staff of life here. These are two of the most ancient foods in the world, beer and cheese. And they grew up together on farms, and in most cases in the world, far away from the things that people think about, like wine. Now, if you uh, if you read wine books, you actually find that wine and cheese together, according to wine experts, kind of tough compared to beer. So
is that really what they say?
That is what they say. You know, so you know, some of them try. You know, here's the thing that people don't know. Take a big winery like Robert Mondavi. They have an entire team of people whose job it is to figure out what dishes taste best with Mondavi wines. They have a team of chefs, like 15, 16 people, a whole department, and they're working on cooking, because they do hundreds of events a year. And what do they want? They want food that tastes good, that does not make Mondavi wine taste bad, and hopefully makes it taste better. And they have people to do this. So I'm talking to you, bigger craft brewers, bigger than us. You know, you guys got some really nice beers. You know, the bigger guys in the world. We're trying to get there. But I think somebody needs to establish, you know, a team of chefs to work on craft beer and food pairings. I'm just saying. Cheese, we always win. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of the way it is. I do competitions versus sommeliers all the time, wine versus beer with cheese. We call it a cheese war in front of an audience, Iron Chef style. And, you know, the question is, will I lop off both of the other person's arms and then run them through, or will it really be a fight? You know, good, really great sommeliers give you a great fight, you know, and I remember every single round that I ever lost.
So Chris and Mary have done a lot of beer and food pairings, and what have been some of the favorites that you've done? Because you're probably in New York area, you guys have done a lot. You have more experience than most people.
As Chris's agent, I really resent this ambush.
But my favorites have definitely been the bacon, chocolate, and beer combos. Like when we do our pairings, we always, you know, we pick with a theme. But generally, we always have three things involved because it's really fun to play off. Not just pairing, it's a trilogy of things, because where you jump off from these three different places can always affect what's going on. And my favorites, of course, bacon and chocolate is awesome.
And bacon, so, chocolate, and beer, isn't that like cheating? I mean, like, you know, like, you kind of can't. How do you go wrong? Are you taking any chances
there? I
think it's
so gluttonous that yes, I do.
And our ice cream and beer pairings were fun.
Oh, those have been great, yeah.
Well, let's talk about our two cheeses here for a minute. You know, people know Ms. Saxelby and her wonderful appanage.
Saxelby Cheesemongers, mm-hmm. S's Streakmark.
Yes. So, do we have the Tarentaise here? I don't, I have tasted it before, but I don't know what that specifically, but I know the overall style. A cow's milk Gruyere style cheese, cooked curd. I think this is technically washed rind, I think. You can actually see the lines of where the cheesecloth was on it. I think that it is actually a brined cheese, but unlike other washed rind cheeses, it doesn't funkify from the outside, you know, in and sort of melt. Rather, it kind of oxidizes and dries and
grays. We're all eating cheese right now.
Yeah, we're so sorry. You know, we just can't.
Eating cheese,
you know,
and drinking,
you know,
beer.
Very soon we're going to learn how to transmit cheese over radio wires, over radio waves.
You can download this cheese.
Here. You download this cheese.
Ann Saxelby's show is every Monday at 5:30. Cutting the curd. Sorry, had to do that.
I didn't even know that. I have to listen to her.
Well, you know, without Ann, we would. Check out Edible Manhattan this month. Without Ann, we would not have American Farm said cheese, and I believe that. She introduced me to it, and I'm very proud to know her.
Mm-hmm. And, I thought you meant the United States would not have it. I was like, wow, she's even cooler than I thought.
She is, man. Come on.
She is cooler than we all think.
But pass the cheese around. Garrett's hogging the cheese. Just so
I,
you know.
I am hogging.
He's got
the
all
cheese.
The cheese. He takes little bites at
no,
a time.
No, I'm talking at the same time. Look, I'm taking little bites at a time. I'm trying to keep things together.
And his buddy Foster is the buyer at Murray's Cheese, which is where Ann started.
Yeah, he will join us soon.
And he's... So you know a lot about food, man. I love that. We made a point when Garrett's on now, we're bringing on food. So last week it was chocolate. This week
it's in
cheese.
My rider, and I don't know. Where are the green M&Ms? You know, yeah. Peeled grapes? I don't know. You guys are falling behind. You used to be like really good. But
so you're saying you're not an expert, that it's just so easy to pair cheese and beer that anyone can do it?
No, well, actually, that's not true, because you know these are quite pairable cheeses. And what is the other one?
One's a Valley Shepherd.
Yes,
which
Valley
is cow
Shepherd.
And sheep's milk
so
cheese.
It's a, so that's a milk blend.
And the other one
it is much sharpish. Well, the thing is that the Gruyere style right here, Gruyeres are known for being kind of nutty and fruity and grassy. And they'll change through the years depending upon when you're getting the milk. If you're getting the milk in the spring, you're going to get the flowers of springtime. You're going to get fresh shoots. During the winter, the cows are being fed on silage. They're getting hay, etc. And it's going to change your milk. It's going to change your cheese. And these cheeses are going to change throughout the year. They tend to have a slightly grainy texture to them rather than being creamy. And they'll age out really nicely. And the best of them, like, say, Rolf Bieler, but this is a beautiful cheese as well, are going to be really super intense. They start slow and they become really explosive. And what's fascinating for me is that American cheese is paralleling American beer. It starts with European traditions that are being riffed upon and then blown up by American cheesemakers. And I think over the next 10 years or so, you're going to see basically situations where so many American cheeses are going to surpass the European
counterparts. So, Garrett, of the beers that we've had so far, we've had a couple of Hitachino, we had your specialty bottling, we have this very unusual Fritz Bream Groot. Which of these do you think goes best with the cheeses in front of us?
Well, see, that's what I've been trying to avoid all this time.
I'd say it's yours.
I think that there are things that I think that the Crochet Rouge can work. I think what you really want, and we don't have on the table at this very moment, for both of these cheeses, are kind of richer, maltier mm-hmm. beers with some caramelized flavors and some nutty flavors. For example, brown ales tend to work really well with a lot of sheep's milk cheeses because sheep's milk has this kind of nutty flavor to it. Yep. The Gruyere, the Tarentaise, has a little bit of what's called lipase character. It's a beautiful by itself as a cheese, but it's a little bit of a live wire. So you gotta play with it a little bit and find what's gonna match up with it.
Mary, what would be some examples of brown ale that would go well with this cheese?
Well, I don't think you'd want too hoppy. Would you agree?
I would agree. Right. I think that's
something that's like an English brown ale.
Exactly. That's the live wire
brands.
Part.
Specific brands.
As your attorney.
Oh, wait. Wait, doesn't Brooklyn make a brown ale?
Oh, we do make
with
a brown
English
ale.
Hops?
Oh, good of you to mention it. I think that
we've used that a lot
from Avery. Yeah, there's Ellie's brown ale from Smutty mm-hmm. Nose, Old Brown Dog. Either one of these would be really good. I think even working at the Porter's, you know, could mm-hmm. be really nice. And the sharpness of of our other cheese, you know, the Shepherd, is really almost cheddarish. I think this could work with IPAs. And I like IPAs with sharper cheeses.
Is that a tough pairing, IPA and food?
I don't think it is, no. I love IPA with spicy food. I love the character, the citrusy character of American hops working with the citrus character that's in Thai food because they're adding lime and lemon juice. It can even work with things that you don't expect, like ceviche, where you're thinking, okay, it's fish and it's acid, but then those citrusy things kind of work together. So I think IPA can be if they're balanced in any way can be great food beers. I'm going tonight in a couple of hours to Chef Floyd Cardoza's new restaurant, North End Grill. He was the chef at Tabla, Danny Meyer's Indian restaurant, which unfortunately closed a little over a year ago after a brilliant 12-year run. And now Floyd is back. He's originally from Goa in India, which is a fascinating area with a distinct food culture born of not only local traditions, but also the Portuguese colonization of that area, which is really different than the rest of India. So that area was Catholic. Vindaloos and things like that were based on pork. And Floyd is a genius of spice. So in my car, I have three bottles of our Blast barley wine. Not barley wine, IPA, that I'm going to give to the kitchen. But I think that beer is going to be really nice with his
What was the beer that you made with him that had all the spices in it? Was it?
It was called Cuvée de Cardoz.
Yeah. That was it, yeah.
It was actually kind of based on Belgian wit beer, but a stronger version at about 8%. And instead of doing Curaçao, orange peel, and coriander, you know, we did a blend of 12 different Indian spices. Now, I see some faces here, you know, among the people. See, here's the thing about cheese.
Wait, it's not that. It's something. It's Mary's homebrew from last year, and she's not happy with it. But I want to backpedal, because I want to go back to...
as your attorney.
Okay, listen. Beer and food pairings. Gary, you have to listen. Beer and food pairings. When I was first getting into it, I always thought, in a pinch, I would go with German beers. Because I felt that they were, by their nature, so food-friendly. You know, someone brought in, I've got wild Alaskan salmon. What would you pair? I'd say, well...
You are calling them simple. You are saying they're very simple.
And they go German wheat beer.
No, but it's not true. They can be wild, too.
So, this is, you know, I'm trying to give you guys a riff. Come on. You guys, and please criticize me. I think that German beer... especially wheat beers, pair very well with food.
Oh, absolutely.
And just by their nature, they're good food beers.
Well, Mary,
that's a blanket statement.
I'm putting this out there. What do you got in this bottle? It's looking at us. You know, there are faces going around. What was it meant to be?
So
and
it's a
what
sour.
Is it today?
So, and I have on here 12/9/2011, but it was bottled a year and a half ago.
I know, you must...
12/9/2010. So this is one of my first sours that I made. I've cultured yeast from bottles, so probably I do it at parties. So this might be a cuvée de Calcium from Captain Lawrence, maybe some Russian River yeast.
Wait, you do it at parties?
Yep.
So okay, there's a party going on, and you are removing yeast from bottles that people have
maybe.
At parties.
Yes,
I'll say this: I tried this. She made a sour. I tried it April of 2010, last year. It was really great. It was fresh. I liked it. Now, almost a year later, it's kind of funked out. Yeah. So. That's okay. That's the nature of, you know, homebrew and experimentation.
It's the last
Absolutely.
Bottle.
Absolutely. It is. This is the last existing bottle.
Let Garrett taste it. I want to see his.
I want to see what face you make.
I want his face.
You know, is there any slime involved? Because,
no slime.
You know, it says on my rider that I can't have any slime.
Garrett, I guess what's missing from Mary's, you know, over the hill sour beer is slime.
Yeah. Got to move into the slime beer category.
Do not laugh. And when you are creating sour beers, there is often...
Oh, yeah.
There is often a phase of sour beer production, which is the ropey phase, the slimy phase, the pectinatus phase, and you have to wait for that to go away.
Okay, Mr. Garrett Oliver, last serious question before we close out. Okay, if you went to Japan, and you went to the Kyuchi Brewery Hitachi No, and you were going to make a beer with Mr. Toshi Kaiuchi, our friend, what would you like to make?
First of all, I kind of like Mary's beer. second of all, what I would like to make, you know, is I was talking to him about whether or not there are sakes that are made with completely natural yeasts and mold, etc., from out of the air, as opposed to adding cultures. I suspect that there have to be. And what I would like to do then is use those cultures without laboratory yeasts and molds, grow those, and use them to create new flavors in beers, maybe aging in sake casks with lees from sakes that are naturally fermented. So it would be a riff on this idea of Crochet Rouge, but the lees, and we've already done this at the brewery. One of my brewers, Dan Moss, has made sake, Yamazaki, and we tried aging some local one out on the sake lees. Now, so far, we're kind of like, we're not sure. But there are all kinds of things like this that we can do. Maybe blended lees from here and lees from there.
Awesome. All right, we're going to have to close out. But first, Heritage Radio Network salutes the shows that have reached the 100-episode mark. That includes Beer Sessions Radio. So we're all combining forces. We're having a big party on March 21st at Santos Party House, downtown New York City. They will be in these orders. It sounds like a classic beer and food pairing. There's cheese, chocolates, charcuterie, and cooking. That's what we've made up. It's going to be a great party. Check out heritageradionetwork.com. There's a little... ticket link. It's $50 a person. Awesome night and featuring some great craft beers and artisanal spirits from the whole region. It's going to be an awesome night out. Many of the hosts, like Ann Sachs, will be Patrick Martins. Hey, Jimmy Carboni will be there. So,
hey,
why not? So HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Check out our party March 21st. We're going to take the new era in Heritage Radio Network is special events, and we'll all be there. And Good Brew Seal events, check out March 7th, the Double Windsor, one of our Good Brew Seal bars. It's having a great night with Captain Lawrence, Kelso, and Allagash. And starting March 10th, 10th, Mugs Ale House. It's one of the best beer events of the year. The Mugs is annual New York City Split Thy Skull Strong Ale Festival. Have you been to that, Garrett, ever?
I have, and those who come to scoff shall remain to pray.
Yes. MugsAleHouse.com. And then again, I'd like to thank our sponsors, GreatBrewers.com. Thanks to you guys, they're renewing again. It's another year with GreatBrewers.com. Beer Sessions Radio is also sponsored by GoodBrewSeal.com. Thanks to Garrett, Chris, and Mary for joining me here tonight on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee, Brie O'Connor, and guest coordinator, Brett Thompson. We'll see you next week on Beer Sessions Radio.
Cheers.
Good night and thank you.
This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.